As it turned out, I did not break my contract, for it was 6 weeks before the Auberge de Géant Cottard even showed signs of opening. In the meantime, I worked at the Hotel X 4 days a week in the cafeterie, one day helping the waiter on the fourth floor, and one day replacing the woman who washed up for the dining room. My day off, luckily, was Sunday, but sometimes another man was ill and I had to work that day as well. The hours were from 7 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, and from 5 in the evening till 9, 11 hours. But it was a 14-hour day when I washed up for the dining room. By the ordinary standards of a Paris plongeur, these are exceptionally short hours. The only hardship of the life was the fearful heat and stuffiness of those labyrinthine cellars. Apart from this, the hotel, which was large and well organized, was considered a comfortable one. Our cafeterie was a murky cellar, measuring 20 feet by 7 by 8 high, and so crowded with coffee urns, bread cutters, and the like, that one could hardly move without banging against something. It was lighted by one dim electric bulb, and 4 or 5 gas fires that sent out a fierce red breath. There was a thermometer there, and the temperature never fell below 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It neared 130 at some times of the day. At one end were 5 service lifts, and at the other an ice cupboard where we stored milk and butter. When you went into the ice cupboard, you dropped 100 degrees of temperature at a single step. It used to remind me of the hymn about Greenland's icy mountains and India's coral strand. 2 men worked in the cafeterie besides Boris and myself. One was Mario, a huge, excitable Italian. He was like a city policeman with operatic gestures. And the other, a hairy, uncouth animal whom we called the Magyar. I think he was a Transylvanian, or something even more remote. Except the Magyar, we were all big men, and at the rush hours we collided incessantly. The work in the cafeterie was spasmodic. We were never idle, but the real work only came in bursts of 2 hours at a time. We called each burst un coup de feu. The first coup de feu came at 8, when the guests upstairs began to wake up and demand breakfast. At 8, a sudden banging and yelling would break out all through the basement. Bells rang on all sides. Blue-aproned men rushed through the passages. Our service lifts came down with a simultaneous crash, and the waiters on all 5 floors began shouting Italian oaths down the shafts. I don't remember all our duties, but they included making tea, coffee and chocolate, fetching meals from the kitchen, wines from the cellar, and fruit and so forth from the dining room, slicing bread, making toast, rolling pats of butter, measuring jam, opening milk cans, counting lumps of sugar, boiling eggs, cooking porridge, pounding ice, grinding coffee, all this for from 100 to 200 customers. The kitchen was 30 yards away, and the dining room 60 or 70 yards. Everything we sent up in the service lifts had to be covered by a voucher, and the vouchers had to be carefully filed, and there was trouble if even a lump of sugar was lost. Besides this, we had to supply the staff with bread and coffee, and fetch the meals for the waiters upstairs. All in all, it was a complicated job. I calculated that one had to walk and run about 15 miles during the day, and yet the strain of the work was more mental than physical. Nothing could be easier, on the face of it, than this stupid scullion work, but it is astonishingly hard when one is in a hurry. One has to leap to and fro between a multitude of jobs. It is like sorting a pack of cards against the clock. You are, for example, making toast when bang, down comes a service lift with an order for tea, rolls and 3 different kinds of jam, and simultaneously bang, down comes another, demanding scrambled eggs, coffee and grapefruit. You run to the kitchen for the eggs and to the dining room for the fruit, going like lightning so as to be back before your toast burns, and having to remember about the tea and coffee, besides 6 other orders that are still pending. And at the same time, some waiter is following you and making trouble about a lost bottle of soda water, and you are arguing with him. It needs more brains than one might think. Mario said, no doubt truly, that it took a year to make a reliable cafetier. The time between 8 and 10:30 was a sort of delirium. Sometimes we were going as though we had only 5 minutes to live. Sometimes there were sudden lulls when the orders stopped and everything seemed quiet for a moment. Then we swept up the litter from the floor, threw down fresh sawdust, and swallowed gallipots of wine or coffee or water, anything, so long as it was wet. Very often we used to break off chunks of ice and suck them while we worked. The heat among the gas fires was nauseating. We swallowed quarts of drink during the day, and after a few hours even our aprons were drenched with sweat. At times we were hopelessly behind with the work, and some of the customers would have gone without their breakfast, but Mario always pulled us through. He had worked 14 years in the cafeterie, and he had the skill that never wastes a second between jobs. The Magyar was very stupid, and I was inexperienced, and Boris was inclined to shirk, partly because of his lame leg, partly because he was ashamed of working in the cafeterie after being a waiter. But Mario was wonderful. The way he would stretch his great arms right across the cafeterie to fill a coffee pot with one hand and boil an egg with the other, at the same time watching toast and shouting directions to the Magyar, and between whiles singing snatches from Rigoletto, was beyond all praise. The patron knew his value, and he was paid 1,000 francs a month, instead of 500 like the rest of us. The breakfast pandemonium stopped at 10:30. Then we scrubbed the cafeterie tables, swept the floor and polished the brasswork, and on good mornings went one at a time to the lavatory for a smoke. This was our slack time. Only relatively slack, however, for we had only 10 minutes for lunch, and we never got through it uninterrupted. The customer's luncheon hour between 12 and 2 was another period of turmoil like the breakfast hour. Most of our work was fetching meals from the kitchen, which meant constant engueulade from the cooks. By this time the cooks had sweated in front of their furnaces for 4 or 5 hours, and their tempers were all warmed up. At 2, we were suddenly free men. We threw off our aprons and put on our coats, hurried out of doors, and when we had money, dived into the nearest bistro. It was strange, coming up into the street from those firelit cellars. The air seemed blindingly clear and cold, like Arctic summer, and how sweet the petrol did smell after the stenches of sweat and food. Sometimes we met some of our cooks and waiters in the bistros, and they were friendly and stood us drinks. Indoors we were their slaves, but it is an etiquette in hotel life that between hours everyone is equal, and the engueulades do not count. At 4:45 we went back to the hotel. Till 6:30 there were no orders, and we used this time to polish silver, clean out the coffee urns, and do other odd jobs. Then the grand turmoil of the day started, the dinner hour. I wish I could be Zola for a little while, just to describe that dinner hour. The essence of the situation was that 100 or 200 people were demanding individually different meals of 5 or 6 courses, and that 50 or 60 people had to cook and serve them and clean up the mess afterwards. Anyone with experience of catering will know what that means. And at this time, when the work was doubled, the whole staff were tired out, and a number of them were drunk. I could write pages about the scene without giving a true idea of it. The chargings to and fro in the narrow passages, the collisions, the yells, the struggling with crates and trays and blocks of ice, the heat, the darkness, the furious festering quarrels which there was no time to fight out, they passed description. Anyone coming into the basement for the first time would have thought himself in a den of maniacs. It was only later, when I understood the working of the hotel, that I saw order in all this chaos. At 8:30, the work stopped very suddenly. We were not free till 9, but we used to throw ourselves full length on the floor and lie there resting our legs, too lazy even to go to the ice cupboard for a drink. Sometimes the chef de personnel would come in with bottles of beer, for the hotel stood us extra beer when we had had a hard day. The food we were given was no more than eatable, but the patron was not mean about drink. He allowed us 2 litres of wine a day each, knowing that if a plongeur is not given 2 litres, he will steal 3. We had the heel taps of bottles as well, so that we often drank too much, a good thing, for one seemed to work faster when partially drunk. 4 days of the week passed like this. Of the other 2 working days, one was better and one worse. After a week of this life, I felt in need of a holiday. It was Saturday night, so the people in our bistro were busy getting drunk, and with a free day ahead of me, I was ready to join them. We all went to bed, drunk, at 2 in the morning, meaning to sleep till noon. At 5:30, I was suddenly awakened. A night watchman, sent from the hotel, was standing at my bedside. He stripped the clothes back and shook me roughly.
"Get up," he said. "Tu t'es bien saoulé la gueule, pas vrai?" "Well, never mind that. The hotel's a man short. You've got to work today."
"Why should I work?" I protested. "This is my day off."
"Day off, nothing. The work's got to be done. Get up."
I got up and went out, feeling as though my back were broken and my skull filled with hot cinders. I did not think that I could possibly do a day's work, and yet, after only an hour in the basement, I found that I was perfectly well. It seemed that in the heat of those cellars, as in a Turkish bath, one could sweat out almost any quantity of drink. Plongeurs know this and count on it. The power of swallowing quarts of wine and then sweating it out before it can do much damage is one of the compensations of their life.